danger is stealing in as relapse comes above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 239 of the Thinking Poker Podcast from a frigid and windy Owings Mills, Maryland. I am Andrew Brokus. As I often have been for the intros of late, I am solo through the strategy segment, soon to be joined by Nate Mavis and Corey Mycastle. I guess I probably should have checked with him how to pronounce his name, but that's probably close. Hopefully that's close. Before I tell you more about Corey, a couple of reminders for you. If you've got any last-minute shopping to do, there is some neat stuff in the knitcast.com store that includes premium podcasts. These are pure strategy-focused podcasts rather than the kind of one-off strategy segments that you hear on this show. They're extended. We have one based on tournament strategy, one based more on small stakes live cash game strategy. That latter one, by the way, featuring fan favorite Carlos Welch quite prominently. These are like multi-hour podcasts, audio of us talking about important strategy concepts for these two game types. Those are both available at knitcast.com. You can also find strategy books written by both Nate and me at knitcast.com store. Also, if you find yourself shopping on Amazon, please use our affiliate link. It doesn't cost you anything extra, but Nate and I will get a little bit of a kickback if you do that. These affiliate links vary by country. So what you can do, if you go to thinkingpoker.net, click on the Support the Podcast tab, then you can find an affiliate link that's relevant for your country. And if you just follow that link, anything that you buy after following that link will get a little piece of that. And that helps us out over the course of the year. This is a time when a lot of people are doing their Amazon shopping. So if you think of it, certainly helps us out there. Last thing I'll beg you for, I'm once again running an end-of-the-year fundraising campaign for the Bay Area Urban Debate League. This is an organization that I'm pretty closely involved with. So, I was a debater in high school. I was a debater in college, meaning I participated in a kind of formalized competitive activity of debate. I feel like it taught me a lot, did a lot to kind of changed my life for the better. Not that my life was really on a bad course, but I think that I got a lot out of participating in debate, and it made me a different and a better person. And I started working with Urban Debate Leagues when I was still in college myself. So I worked with the Urban Debate League in Chicago. I actually founded the Urban Debate League in Boston and ran that for several years. And then I started working with the Bay Area Urban Debate League when I moved to San Francisco. I'm currently a member of its board of directors, which means that I do have some insight into how the organization spends its money. So, those of you who are concerned about these organizations just spend all their money on fundraising or, money given to nonprofit organizations is really inefficient. I mean, there are organizations out there that spend their money more or less well. This is one that I can vouch for. It's one that I contribute to, and it's one in whose governance I participate. So, I vouch for it, bottom line. We've had a lot of success. This is the third year that I've run this campaign, had a lot of success with it. Our goal really more so than getting large dollar amounts, of course, those are always nice, but what they're really interested in is the number of donors. So even if you're only able to give a small amount, it still makes a big difference in terms of in terms of my clout with the organization, frankly, and also just for the organization and for the campaign in general. Got a couple of rewards for people who are participating. So if you contribute $10 or more to the campaign, you'll be entered into a drawing for prizes that'll include a free custom video, an item from the knitcast.com store, even an opportunity to come on the Thinking Poker podcast and talk strategy with us. Also, for every $1,000 raised, I'm going to be creating a free hour of poker strategy content that I will make available. So as for every $1,000 we raise, a new hour is going to be unlocked, and this campaign will run until the end of the year. To contribute, you can either go to Razoo, R-A-Z-O-O.com, and search for my name, which is Andrew Brokos, B as in boy, R-O-K-O-S. Or if you just go to thinkingpoker.net and look on the show notes for any of the recent podcast episodes, including this one, 239, and you'll find a direct link to the campaign where you can contribute. It would mean a lot to me. I know that this is an organization that that will use your money well and that does good work. So our guest today, Corey Mikesel. Apologies, Corey, if I'm mispronouncing that. I really enjoyed this interview a lot, and I don't mean to sound surprised when I say actually. I mean, the truth is, I really didn't know what to expect from it. Corey's not someone I know well. It turns out actually that I had met Corey in person, although I did not know much about him, and I wasn't really sure what we were going to talk about in this episode besides PLO and game theory. It turns out there is a lot to Corey. Corey is the author of a book called PLO Three Bet Pots, Game Theory and Practice, Unexploitable Strategies for Beating Tough Games. And this is a very, very advanced PLO game theory book. It's also a quite expensive PLO book. I think it's primarily for really serious PLO players, but you know, Corey understands the concepts very well, and I think is capable of explaining some pretty complicated stuff in a way that's, I mean, I'm not going to say it's easy to understand because it's you know, complicated and advanced information, but you know, I think it's clear that he has a good grasp of the information, and he explains himself quite well. So you know, this is why I knew like part of what we were going to be talking about was PLO and game theory, but I didn't really know a whole lot more about him besides that. It turns out I actually had met him in person once when I was living and playing poker in Pittsburgh. He's from Ohio. He introduced himself and, you know, we spoke for a little bit and then hadn't really spoken since, and I actually didn't even remember. I mean, his name looked kind of familiar when we started talking about having him on the show, but I didn't actually remember where I had met him or where I had seen his name before. But it turns out that Corey, in addition to having gotten really, really deeply into poker, and we'll talk about what it means for Corey to get really deeply into something, but he gets deep into it. So besides poker, he's also thrown himself into chess and into writing, actually, and we talk a lot to him about all those things. Corey also talks about some of the struggles that he's had with mental health issues and the role that poker has played in all that. Seems like it's kind of been in some ways helpful and maybe in some ways harmful as well, but he's very honest and open in talking about it, which we always appreciate. And of course, there will be the talk about PLO and game theory. And you know, as much as we've talked about game theory on the show, we've never really talked about it in the context of PLO specifically. And Corey will give us an opportunity to do a little bit of that. You know what else might make a good gift this holiday season for yourself, if not for the poker fans in your life? A subscription to Tournament Poker Edge. For as little as $25 a month, it's a gift that can keep on giving throughout the year and really throughout your poker career. With new poker strategy videos added to their already huge library almost every day, you'll find videos from Spin and Go tournaments, Heads Up tournaments, Microstakes, Satellites, The Scoop, the W-Coupe, the World Poker Tour, the World Series of Poker, all sorts of tournaments, all sorts of stakes, all of it available at tournamentpokeredge.com. Strategy question today is coming from Ben. Ben played this in a 1-2, no limit hold'em game. He says, I open the pot in the hijack to $12 with two red 10s. Villain calls on the button and both blinds fold. Although I've played with this player many times, his range is not very well established in my mind. He never shows his cards. He's certainly a thinking player who takes the game seriously. He has a notebook and takes notes constantly during his sessions. I put his range around suited connectors down to 7-6, pocket deuces through pocket jacks, any suited Broadway cards, many offsuit Broadway combos. With the pot at $20 after rake, the flop comes jack of diamonds, jack of hearts, five of clubs. I check for a couple of reasons. If I bet, villain will likely call whether he has a jack or nothing. I will gain no information if he calls, and the pot will be bigger. I figure with a check, I can play a little pot control and see what he thinks of this flop. I think to myself, man, do I wish I had position right now. Villain checks behind. The turn is the six of diamonds. I lead out for $15, thinking this is half for value and half for feeling out where the hell we are here. I don't want to give him another free card if he holds two overs, or if he improved to a flush or straight draw, which is what I put him on. So a 75% pot bet into a small pot makes the most sense to me. Villain calls. $50 in the pot, and the river brings the seven of hearts, making the final board Jack of diamonds, Jack of hearts, five of clubs, six of diamonds, seven of hearts, our hero once again holding red tens. I lead out for another $15, thinking he will either fold or maybe call with ace high or a small pair he picked up along the way with his suited connector. Well, as Tommy Angelo would say, I got gobsmacked when the villain raised to $65. So it's $50 more to win $115. In hindsight, I should have check called as long as the bet was reasonable. A big blunder on my part, I think. I tank for a bit and come to the conclusion that... Actually, you know, let's stop there before we get to the results. Let me talk a little bit about the hand, but even more so than the hand. I think there's something deeper going on here, which is, I think, a common misconception about what you should be doing at the poker table, or kind of what your objective should be while in a poker hand. So we can see throughout this hand, you know, Ben is very concerned about understanding, you know, where he's at. And in other words, trying to get better, if not perfect, information about what the opponent's hand might be. And I think that as nice as it is to have that information, and it's not impossible to get when you're playing against certain sorts of like very weak opponents. I mean, sometimes in live poker it can happen. But fundamentally, poker is a game about making good decisions with imperfect information. And I think if you approach poker with the mindset of, you know, I'm just gobsmacked, as it were. I have no idea what to do unless I have, you know, very good information about my opponent's hand. Like, often you're not going to have that information. Often it's going to be the case that your opponent can have lots of different sorts of hands, and you need to figure out how best to play your hand given all those different combinations your opponent could have. The best play is not generally to you know, make a play that forces your opponent to define his hand, even if you can do that, which I think a lot of people, including Ben here, kind of overestimate their ability to force their opponent to define his hand. But even if you were able to do that, generally the process of doing that, I mean, what you're doing in the process is helping your opponent play his hand perfectly. So, you know, let's suppose it were true. Like, I think... I mean, Ben actually kind of makes the opposite argument here, which I'll address, but a lot of times people have the idea of, you know, I'll bet the flop to see where I'm at. And the idea is like, well, if I'm beat, my opponent will you know, call or raise me, and then I'll know that I'm beat. And if he folds, then I'll know that I have the best hand. All right, so even if that's true, even if your opponent will respond in that very reliable way, how has that actually helped you, right? If you bet and your opponent folds, okay, you found out that you have the best hand, but there's nothing more you can do with that information. You've already won the pot, and you were going to win the pot, probably even if you didn't bet, because you had the best hand. So you didn't really accomplish that much by betting. And if you bet and you get called or raised, okay, now you know that you don't have the best hand. What can you do with that information? All you can do is avoid putting money in the pot, except you've already put money in the pot. So I think the thing is, oftentimes, like, information, even when you can get it reliably, and I think most people overestimate how often they can do that, even when you can get information reliably, it's often difficult to, like, you overpay for that information, or you only get the information once you've reached a point where you can't do anything of great use with it anymore. So I think the much better thing is to try to find ways to induce your opponents to make mistakes with certain kinds of hands. And you can't always prevent them from making mistakes with their entire range. Like, when your opponent has a truly awful hand, he's probably just going to fold to a bet. And when he has a really great hand, there's not going to be a way that you can prevent him from putting some money in the pot. But most hands don't fall into those two categories. Like, plenty of hands fall in the category of, like, good but not great, interested in seeing the next card, some chance of winning at showdown. And those kinds of hands, you do have some control over what happens with them. And you really want to think about optimizing against that portion of your opponent's range. All right, so with that overview in mind, let's talk a little bit more about some of the specific situations in which Ben finds himself. So opening preflop, you know, $12 strikes me as kind of a large preflop raise, but I can certainly imagine games where, you know, it's kind of loose and people, you know, will call large raises like that with poor hands, in which case it would certainly be appropriate or you know, ideal to make large open raises. The one thing I would want to be careful about, I have no idea whether this is what's happening, is, you know, Ben, that you're not changing your raise size based on your hand. So what you don't want to be doing is making it $12 when you have tens, but only making it $8 when you have ace-jack or something like that. Especially if you have a thoughtful opponent like this villain in the game, that's not a difficult pattern to pick up on, and it will enable him to play well against you. Like, at the same time that, as much as we've talked about the value of, you know, potentially getting information from your opponent, or, you know, as concerned you are as you are about getting information about your opponent's hand, you also want to avoid giving him information about your own hand. You want to create as much uncertainty about your own hand as you can, and, you know, so just not changing your preflop raise size is a one simple way of doing that. But okay, we open to $12, get called by the villain on the button. I think that the range Ben gives him sounds reasonable. I mean, I would say he probably shouldn't be calling with, like, Queen 10 offsuit or 7-6 suited, you know, if those are hands that Ben is suggesting he might have. But then again, I mean, that doesn't mean he's not. Like, maybe this is a guy who does call a little too wide in these kind of situations. So I think, you know, the range that Ben suggests is pretty reasonable. So we go to the flop. There's two jacks on the board, and there's a five. And I think the right thing that should be going through your mind when you see this flop is, I have a very good hand, right? You have pocket tens. There's no overcard to the tens on the board. That's not the same as saying I'm 100% sure that I have the best hand. And I think when you see this flop, your first thought shouldn't be, oh crap, how do I make sure I don't lose very much money if my opponent just flop trips? You know, your opponent is not going to flop trips very often. Flopping trips is a difficult thing to do. Most of the time, your opponent is going to have a hand that is worse than pocket tens. Some of those hands are hands that will be willing to put money into the pot, and you would like them to do that. Some of them are hands that, even if they're not going to put money in the pot, you don't really benefit from giving them a free card, because the only time when they will put money in the pot is if they improve to the point where they beat pocket tens. So if your opponent has a hand like king queen or something, you know, there's a lot of ways that king queen could improve. Well, not a lot, but it can improve to a pair of kings or queens relatively easily, and it's not really in your advantage to allow them to do that. So what I would be thinking when I see this flop is, I have a pretty good hand, a hand that can still expect to be ahead of my opponent's range as money goes into the pot, and also a hand that benefits to some degree from protection. Even though there's not obvious draws on the board, just, you know, not letting my opponent get a free card when he has an ace or a king or a queen in his hand, or, you know, backdoor draw or something like that, I have some interest in my opponent's folds. I also have some interest in my opponent's calls. Even though I'm not going to be ahead 100% of the time that my bet is called, I think it's pretty safe to say that, I mean, especially if, as Ben believes, I mean, Ben says that he thinks this player is going to call a bet whether or not he has anything. So what that means is that you're going to be a huge favorite when that bet goes into the pot. If you bet here and you think your opponent is literally never folding, then tens is going to be a huge favorite against that range, even though that range does contain a few hands that are better than the tens. You basically just have to suck it up and say, in exchange for getting value from all those hands out there that are worse than tens, I accept that every once in a while I'm going to lose a pot to a hand that's better than tens. And overall, that's a good wager for you. You're wagering that you have the best hand, and most of the time you're going to be right. Now here's where we get into the part where I say, even when you try to do something to gain information, I think you tend to, or not you specifically, Ben, but people tend to overestimate how much information they're actually gaining from the thing that they do. So, you know, you check and you say, or, you know, Ben checks and Ben says, I want to see what the villain thinks of this flop. All right, villain checks behind. What did you learn? Did you learn that he doesn't have a jack? Probably not, because, you know, by the time we got to the river, he's raising, and now you're at least considering the possibility that maybe he did have a jack. So the fact that he checked the flop didn't, you know, definitively establish for you whether or not he had a jack. All it did was it enabled him to get closer to showdown with some hands that would have put money into the pot, but instead they got to, like, as much as you're talking about you want to play pot control, if your opponent has, you know, ace nine, if your opponent has ace queen, for that matter, if your opponent has pocket sixes, those hands have a lot more interest in pot control than yours do, especially when you're holding pocket tens. Those hands have a lot of interest in pot control. So you've enabled your opponent to do exactly what he wanted with those hands, which is, you know, get a free card when he has hands that are live against pocket tens, keep the pot small when he has a hand like pocket sixes that would have paid off a bet, and if he did have a jack, you know, okay, you avoided putting a bet into the pot, but I don't know that that was a worthwhile trade-off. And it sounds, I mean, we also didn't really talk about what you're going to do if the opponent bets the flop. Like, I certainly don't think you should be check folding here. So even if he has a jack, like, checking doesn't actually prevent you from putting a bet into the pot against the jack. But, you know, checking basically just puts the opponent in control of, he can still play a large pot when he wants to, but he can keep the pot smaller when he wants to also. And I think what Ben says that's very wise, he says, man, do I wish I had position. And I mean, although I disagree that we should even be trying to play pot control in this spot, I also think it's an important lesson that it's not really something you can do from out of position, right? The imposition player is in control of the pot. Even if you check, the imposition player still has the option to put a bet into the pot. So, you know, if you're in position and it's checked to you, you can check behind and guarantee that no bet goes into the pot on this current street. If you're out of position, you don't have that power. So even if your opponent does have a jack, if he wants to put a bet into the pot, he can do it. And he can do it by betting when you check. So you can't really control the pot from out of position. We go to the turn. So board now, jack, jack, 6-5, two diamonds on the board. And I think once again, we see Ben falling into this trap of, you know, wanting to have information about the opponent's hand. Because, you know, Ben makes this comment that he puts his opponent on a flush or straight draw. And I really don't see where that's coming from. Other than, you know, like, flush and a straight draw being on the board, we really have no information about the opponent's hand. Like, what did he do to indicate that he has a flush or straight draw? No money has even gone into the pot yet. Like, why couldn't he have king-queen? Why couldn't he have pocket fours? This is even before the turn bet is called. Ben is already saying he puts him on a flush or straight draw. And I think that this kind of strikes me as some more... It's in keeping with the kind of worst case scenario thinking on the flop. Like, right away on the flop, you're thinking, oh no, what if he has trips? And now there's a draw on the board, and you're thinking, oh no, what if he has the draw? And again, it's when I talk about making decisions under conditions of uncertainty, you have to consider all of the things your opponent might have, rather than just zeroing in on one or two possibilities and then trying to play around those couple of possibilities. So although I do like betting the turn, part of the reason for betting the turn is that he might have a draw, I think there are a lot of other good reasons for betting the turn as well, and I think a lot of those reasons apply to the flop as well. I would have bet the flop. I think it's good that you bet the turn. And when villain calls, I do think we're getting some information about his hand, in that he's probably folding some of his worst hands. Like, I wouldn't even necessarily expect that he would call with, like, King 10 or something on the flop. Ben seemed to think that he might. But, I think when he calls the turn, his range gets stronger. And generally, when people put money in the pot, their ranges get stronger. That's not necessarily bad for us, because I still think we're ahead of that stronger range. I mean, stronger here can mean a draw, it can mean any pair. It's just stronger than, like, I think he's folding his very weakest hands, which is fine, because we don't want those very weakest hands to get a free card on the river, and they probably weren't going to pay us off anyway. So, we have some indication the opponent has some coordination with this board, but that doesn't mean that tens are beat. In fact, I would still expect that tens are good most of the time, which is why I'm happy to be putting this bet in. We go to the river with $50 in the pot. Final board is jack, jack, 5-6-7. And I like betting. In fact, I would bet more than $15. I think that there's really not a whole lot you're going to lose to here. 9-8 is not super likely for the opponent, given that he would have had to call the turn bet with a gut shot in order to get there. I think the most likely holding for the opponent, as Ben points out, is going to be a pocket pair, a suited connector that made a pair. And it's important to note that we're beating a hand like 7-6 suited, even though 7-6 suited, there's a 7 and a 6 on the board. Because the board is jack-jack 7-6-5, we have jacks and 10s, 7-6 suited has jacks and 7s. So even a lot of suited connectors, you're not going to be losing to, even if you made two pair with the suited connector. So I think there's a lot of hands you can beat, and I think your opponent has incentive to call. I mean, whether or not he will, I don't know, but I think he has incentive to call with a lot of those pairs they beat, and I think this is just a pretty straightforward bet for value. It does suck when you get raised here. There's no doubt about that. And sometimes this just happens. It doesn't mean that your bet was wrong. Checking and calling, the only reason to check and call is to induce a bluff. Essentially what you're doing, like, this is just an example of why playing out of position is difficult. You only have two choices with this hand on the river, I think. You can either bet the river and accept that you're going to be in a bad spot if he raises, or you can check and call the river. Those are your two choices. And it seems pretty results-oriented to me to say, well, because he raised the river, it turns out I should have checked and called. Right? I don't think it's at all a guarantee that he's going to raise the river. And I think that a lot of bad things happen when you check. The main bad thing that's going to happen when you check is that he's going to probably check behind a bunch of hands that you could beat. So if he has the ace high, if he has a hand like pocket fours, a lot of people, are passive enough that they're even going to check behind a hand like ace six or 8-7, or just like some relatively strong hands that you're ahead of, he still might check behind. And that's really bad for you. Like, I think Ben is maybe very focused on not wanting to end up in a particular kind of bad spot, but you're losing a lot of money when your opponent checks behind with a hand that would have called, say, a $35 bet, right? If he would have called $35 with A6, and instead he gets to just check it down on the river with A6, you lost $35. And that's a pretty expensive thing. And I think he's going to have a hand like that quite often. And so when you check and let him check those hands down, you're very consistently losing that river bet. In terms of, you know, not wanting to pay off a jack, like, I think that you're not going to end up... Like, the thing that kind of sucks about betting and folding to a raise is you don't actually get to see your opponent's hand. And the more that your opponent is actually capable of raising as a bluff in this situation, the more expensive it gets. Because if you do fold to a raise and you know you don't just lose your bet, you lose the entire pot that you would have won if you had checked and called on the river. However, betting and folding to a jack is not a big deal because you were going to lose a bet to a jack regardless. Like, let's say that you would have checked and called a bet of $35 and instead you bet $35 and then you fold to a raise. Either way, you lost $35 when your opponent had a jack. So you haven't lost yourself anything additional by betting and folding to the raise. What you've gained is you've gained the value from the times that your opponent calls with a hand that tens was ahead of. So the only time that you really lose by betting and folding to a raise is when your opponent raises as a bluff. I think that a lot of people, especially 1-2 players, are probably not raising this spot very often as a bluff. And I think, you know, Ben came to that same conclusion. He said, you know, my opponent just always has it here and folds. So I think that, you know, Ben, I would say that you are right to fold, and that you're right to bet. I would have bet earlier in the hand. I think your hand is actually good enough to bet three streets. Like, I would bet flop, turn, and river here, and then just fold if I got raised. Which, by the way, will also make it a little more difficult for your opponent to raise you because your betting line is more consistent with you having a jack, and so it's harder for him to bluff raise you. But that's a bit of an aside there. But yeah, I mean, I think it's just as unfortunate it is when you get raised here, especially if you're occasionally getting bluffed, it doesn't mean that the bet is bad. You know, it's just kind of focusing on the worst possible thing that could have happened after betting, which in this case did actually happen. But there's a lot of good outcomes that can come from betting as well. So results, Ben says, I tank for a bit and come to the conclusion that he just always has it here. Whether it's a jack, set, or straight, I'm unsure. The only thing he could have that I beat is missed diamonds with an ace that he's turning into a bluff, or possibly a hand like 8-7 suited that he thinks is good. And let me just interject my own opinion here for a second. I really don't think he's going to have the 8-7. I think when he raises here, it's going to be very polarized. It's either he's got trips or better, or he's bluffing. I don't think he's bluffing all that often. Even if you're right that, like, he could either have trips or, you know, exactly missed diamonds, there's more combinations of trips most likely than there are of missed diamonds. So, and probably more than two times as many, such that even if that were his range, you probably still wouldn't be correct to call. I don't think he's going to be raising a second best hand for value. And actually, Ben addresses this. He says, if he's thinking he has the best hand with a hand like A7, why wouldn't he just call? I agree with that. I think he probably will just call with those hands. So Ben says, I conclude my tens are just a bluff catcher, and quote, they always have it here. Shout out for they always have it, because they do always have it. I fold, villain doesn't show, and wouldn't talk about the hand later as expected. Good fold, good bet on the river, good bet on the turn. In fact, I would bet larger on the river, and I would bet the flop. I appreciate you submitting the hand. The bottom line bit of advice is, I think you're doing some worst case scenario thinking, I think that's, you know, good to be aware of that so you can catch yourself and stop yourself from doing it in the future. And I think you really just want to reorient your thinking towards poker in general, you know, away from this idea of wanting to have very reliable information about your opponent's hand, and more towards thinking about a broad range of hands and how your hand interacts with all the different kinds of hands that might be in that range. Thanks again, Ben. Thanks to you all for listening, and thanks to the excellent Corey McKessel for talking to us. I hope you enjoy the interview.
Hi, my name's Gina, and if you've been listening to Thinking Poker for a while now, chances are you've also heard music from my old band, Palmyra. And if you've liked what you've heard, this news is for you. I now have a brand new project called Soft Center, along with Sean Lango, also of Palmyra and an editor on this show. We recently launched a pre-order for our debut album on Kickstarter. Check it out now at softcenter.band, and thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Nate. This episode was a special case, audio-wise. Andrew's computer was not able to record any audio, and I was only able to join by my phone. So, as a result, we only have one audio recording for the episode, and there's a lot of extra background noise from me. I tried to make myself a pot of coffee and do so very, very quietly during the episode, and our kind audio editor, Sean, informs me that this was a total failure. So, I'm very sorry for all the background noise and for generally the uneven audio quality for this episode. We are working to put systems in place so that our future episodes are a lot better in this respect. So, thank you very much, and we hope you enjoy the episode.
Nice to officially meet you, and here, I've heard you guys talking for a long time, but not usually responding to my voice.
Yeah, I like to imagine that you've spent lots of time talking to us, like yelling at the radio as you're listening to us on a morning commute, and only now do we have to respond to your polemics.
Right. Like, well, you're not wrong. I definitely have. I started listening when I was like really at the beginning of my poker career. So the strategy was kind of like, it was a stretch for me at times. But it was a good stretch. And so I've seen my own progress, get to the point where now I can kind of yell back at you guys sometimes, but not always.
Well, I'm sure anytime that we're discussing a PLO hand, there's something to yell about. Okay, no comment.
Polite silence. Good. Yes.
Yeah. You guys want to come play in my home game?
It depends what the lineup's like. It's
sorry. What was that, Nate?
I was going to say, it depends what the lineup's like. I'm okay being a dog to a couple people. If right. Yeah. Sorry. You were going to say, Andrew.
No, I was going to say, I realized, Corey, when, because it was John Beaupre who suggested that we bring you on the show, and your name did look sort of familiar to me when he wrote it, but I just, you know, there's so many good poker players out there these days, I was like, oh, I guess he's just some, like, you know, PLO player I've vaguely heard of or something, and then when you wrote me, and you reminded me, or, you know, that said that we actually had met in Pittsburgh, that all, it came back to me, and I certainly do remember that encounter, and it was actually I'm really not terribly interested in chess, or it's not something that I do much of, but you happened to stumble across me while I was like sitting in that, I was sitting in that coffee shop near the poker room, just like doing a chess problem on my phone, which is something I almost never do. So it's funny that you managed to stumble across me doing that.
Yeah. It was a really nice interaction, and you invited me to walk outside on the grounds, which I had never, I'd spent some time in the casino, but never actually walked outside of it, other than to like get in my car and drive and sulk and drive home.
Yeah, it's really nice out there with rivers and everything.
What did you say?
It's really nice out there with the rivers and everything.
Oh, it is. Yeah, it's a gorgeous location. I'm just disappointed that I didn't spend more time outside. I recently went back. My parents now live in Pittsburgh, and I went to see a band called The National that was playing in an outdoor venue kind of right next to the stadium. So got to appreciate it finally.
And you're from Ohio originally?
Yeah, I'm from the Akron, Canton area. So kind of for landmarks for people who don't know where that is, that's where LeBron went to high school. I actually went to a Catholic school, and our basketball games would occasionally be hosted in the gym at St. Vincent St. Mary's. So LeBron was actually at one of my basketball games. It's unclear whether he was there to see me play or he just happened to be there. I mean, you can't read it either way.
Yeah. You must have been at least a decent basketball player then if you're playing in high school.
No, this was like eighth grade, but I was okay. I started getting interested in chess around 15, 16. So after that, team sport, the allure of team sports kind of drifted away, and I just hyper-focused on chess. kind of to the neglect of my studies as well.
Yeah, I don't think that's a transition a lot of people make, basketball to chess, but I could be off about that.
Yeah, I think I would say, I mean, I was like a late bloomer in terms of sports, but I think my real first passion had been writing. And so I guess in terms of like things that I really loved and deeply kind of internalized and worked at, I would say writing was the first one. And then that kind of took a backseat to chess in high school.
What were you writing?
It was just different kinds of like short fiction. A lot of them were just like assignments for school. But then I got interested in writing poetry. But I kind of had the appreciation for writing crushed out of me at this Catholic grade school that I'd gone to, because they would accuse me of cheating and of plagiarism so often that I would have to dumb down my work for them to accept it. There were several papers that I got rejected. And so I just kind of like, that was pretty crushing. But I think that stemmed from like really, like I think at the age of maybe 10 or 11, I really fell in love with reading and just kind of like devoured the entire school library, and that's where the writing started.
Is that something that you've kept up with at all, the writing?
Recently, yeah. Coming back to write this book kind of reinvigorated my desire to do things creatively. I felt like that creative urge had been kind of stultified from years of playing poker, so I actually just recently started a short story collection, which maybe when I get more progress on, I'll submit to you guys for your literary criticism. I'm actually going to try to get it published. One of my short stories is called The Tiny Thespian, Thespian with a T-H, the tiny thespian that lives inside of Donald Trump. And so it's his... it's like an inner actor that's like clawing its way out and like kind of breaching his sanity. It's supposed to be a comedy, so we'll see whether it's funny or not.
Do you think, is that informed by your own view of Trump? If it is, that puts you at odds with some other people. I think it wasn't Didion. It was somebody who said that this is a man unburdened by the rumblings of a soul. And this is before he had any political career. And whether you want to put it in that way, I sometimes I'm tempted by the view that he doesn't have a whole lot of inner life. In some ways that like an athlete often is not going to be the most reflective kind of person. Like he sees and reacts and he's just not that introspective. But do you think that like there are these inner wars within Trump? Is that your view of him?
That's a good question. I think it's certainly possible. So maybe this is like a slightly optimistic view that there's something deeper going on and it's just manifesting in the most inane, narcissistic way possible. But I'm very reluctant to make such a huge assumption about a person, even one that I strongly dislike. I mean, I think the thing that I constantly discover is whenever I think that I know someone or someone is kind of like fits into a nice neat box that is easy for me to quantify, they usually like in the next minute of conversation surprise me with something that seems totally kind of out of what I would expect them to do. So it's maybe more hopeful. I certainly am not painting a positive picture of him, but maybe a little bit more tragic than like purely villainous.
Have you read David Foster Wallace's essays? Have you read How Tracy Austin Broke My Heart, and the one about Michael Joyce and grotesquerie? And if not, not.
No, I do have Consider the Lobster on my bookshelf, but it's kind of sitting there taunting me, and I've been going through other fiction before I've gotten there, so I can't say that I have.
Yeah. It just seems to me there's an argument in there that the flattering-unflattering distinction sort of cuts across the very interior, not very interior distinction. And with athletes is an example of somebody who, of people who, at least on this view, don't have a lot of interiority all the time, but can be very sort of sensitive and successful people. So, but yeah, so Trump, thespian, people inside him trying to get out. Good luck with the story.
What was it about chess that caught your interest?
For something to help me stand out. I had kind of always been the kid who was very bright, didn't necessarily apply himself, but I didn't have something to either like hang my hat on to really like give me individuality or kind of separate me. Or I think I had also grown up on at least my father's side in kind of an abusive household. And so there was partly an escape element to it, like living in an alternative reality. And I think part of it was like creating individuality and like creating something that I could excel at. I had a number of friends who were interested, and then within a couple months, I was just miles better than them, and they couldn't really compete. And so it was kind of like a reinforcing cycle at that point. I think I have the natural inclination towards like spatial reasoning, but it was also just like really, really fun, and like lit a fire that I didn't really have up to that point, for whatever reason.
What was the process of, getting that good that quickly to the point where you were beating, maybe beating all of your friends isn't that much of an accomplishment when you're 15 or whatever, but.
Right. Yeah, it's devour every book. I can think of like rereading and rereading one book by a guy named, an American grandmaster named Yasser Seirawan. And I went through it each game probably 20, 30 times to the point where I had him memorized, knew almost all of the different variations. I mean, I was in when I should have been paying attention in calc. I had figured out a way to put a chessboard on my graphing calculator. And so I was sitting there analyzing chess when I should have been learning to do integrals. It was just like being completely enveloped in it. That's all I thought about over the summers. I would sit in a dark room for like 12 hours and just like have two boards set up in front of me. And I'd have like the main board and then my analysis board. Little did I know that I could also be doing this on a computer much faster.
Speaking of interiority, how is this, like, when you want to study chess now, if you do want to study chess now, what you can do is sit down with one of the best players in the world, who happens to be a computer, and train a lot that way. And I know for me, poker study got a lot different when these online tools got available. And it was It's more effective and it's more efficient in a lot of ways from the perspective of learning, but something of the sort of personal interior intensity of it is, for me at least, a little bit lost. Is that something you found in chess? Do you miss the sitting in a corner with two chessboards kind of study?
Yeah, there is definitely something that appeals to that. There's something about it that allows me to get into a flow state more, I believe. I don't know why that is. It might just be that I tell myself or allow myself to get into that state more readily. I think that for whatever reasons, just like looking at it two-dimensionally on a screen doesn't connect with my brain the same way seeing it in the third dimension and like seeing kind of the pieces interact with each other. And that's strange because I've almost played, other than like the very beginning of my career, I've almost played no live poker. And so it's, I have a very different relationship to poker, whereas I think chess, there was maybe much more of a love element, a more of like kind of a naive love in some way. But yeah, there's definitely that. There's definitely something lost when you're sitting there and the computer is just churning out endless streams of variations.
So, what is your relationship with poker? How do you study it? Is it, you know, do you love it a little bit, or is it just, you know, the thing you do to make money? And if you could make money playing chess, you'd rather be doing that.
Yeah, I think I kind of have an unusual poker origin story, because I came to poker with the expressed intention of being a professional. Like, I had played the 50 hands of poker with friends in a home game once before deciding I'd become a professional poker player, and that was many years before. That was in high school when I was 16. I didn't think about it until talking with a couple chess friends, one of whom you actually might know, an old 2+2er, Dr. Elo, a limit hold'em player back in the day.
Yep, very good limit hold'em poster too.
Yeah, and so he's also is a pretty strong chess player, about master strength, I think. And so I knew that poker was a possibility, and I knew that I it was going to be difficult for me to like accrue wealth otherwise. So I just decided I would become a professional and spent like maybe a year not even playing, but like reading every book that I could find and like watching. I started out watching old Poker After Dark episodes and quickly realized that was not a useful study mechanism. And so, yeah, it was. I guess most people kind of fall into poker as like a hobby and then progress into it, and like it slowly becomes a profession. But for me, it started out explicitly as a profession.
And I guess making a living in games is something that you wanted to do a lot. Like, if you're the sort of person who just sort of knows he can be good enough at poker to make money at it, you could also be good enough at programming computers to make probably more money at that. But making your living playing a game is something that's like a part of you and something that was kind of non-negotiable or highly desirable, at least. Is that fair?
Maybe. I think that being unconventional was my main driver. I think I had a sense from a very early age that working for someone else or just living any kind of conventional life was just really unappealing to me. I think I had that feeling even before I knew what a convention, my definition of a conventional life looked like. And so I think I was drawn to either living on the fringes or just being able to live a life where no one tells me what to do other than myself. I've always had that kind of, or once I encountered chess, I realized I had that internal motivation where I can set my own schedule, not have a boss, and still get as much or more done than I would working in an office. So I think that is more a driver than games itself, because like now I feel I'm drifting away from poker and I want to see if I can have some success in writing. And then I think coding is another thing that's interesting to me, but I would also code for myself and make my own products or solve my own problems with coding as opposed to working for someone else.
Yeah. Yeah. Very cool. So how are you training yourself at writing? There's not in the same way computer programs you can play against. It's a different sort of it's a different sort of practice, but it undeniably requires tons and tons of practice. How do you work at it?
Yeah, reading is probably the first best way to train writing. So this year I've really kind of stepped up the number of books that I've been reading and kind of focusing more on the mechanics. I recently read It by Stephen King for the first time and just like really internalized the mechanics of creating suspense, the way his pacing, word choice, how it's always kind of like designed to be unsettling. And so I think that's a big training. I actually just bought On Writing by Stephen King. Mm-hmm. So that'll probably be the next book that I jump into. The other thing is just like repetition and just forcing yourself to write 500 or 1,000 words every day. I think that's got to be a big part of it too.
Yeah, I was going to disagree with you. I think reading is not the best, but the second best thing you can do to improve your writing. The number one thing you can do to improve your writing is writing. Is it the best, just mechanically, not overall, not in terms of its like message or politics or whatever, but just in the terms of the mechanics of the writing, is it the best book you've read this year?
That's a good question. I'm halfway through The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. So that's already pretty high on the list. I read East of Eden right before this. Mm-hmm. That's just devastating, but I think it's devastating more based on the plot and like the final word as opposed to the mechanics of the writing. Although of course John Steinbeck mechanically is a fine writer. It probably is at least the most interesting, if not the best. I read Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep and Handmaid's Tale earlier in the year, and I mean you can see why they're classics, but I'm not sure that they stack up mechanically in the same way.
Sure.
How are you choosing the books that you're, you know, if you are kind of trying to read them with an eye towards the technicality of them, how are you making those choices about which books to study?
Well, I only recently started getting back into writing, so I think it was accidental. I was at a bookstore with a friend, and we had just attended a lecture, and I was looking around for new fiction, and then kind of stumbled on It and knew that the remake was coming out. And then the book is so long that like there was kind of like a sea change that had happened in my life where I felt like I was transitioning more away from poker. And then I was getting more interested in writing because I was also finishing this PLO book. And so I just kind of like started reading in like a slightly different way, even though like the writing that I had been doing was purely technical. I think I just started to appreciate it in a way that I hadn't before. And then that made me rethink writing. So there actually hasn't been much of a plan. It's kind of actually worked the other direction, really.
How did you choose PLO specifically, or I mean, was that a conscious choice that you made when you said, okay, I want to be a professional poker player? Did you kind of go from there to saying, and PLO is the game that I'm going to focus on?
No, I started out in No Limit. PLO has only been kind of a recent addition. And like a lot of the money that I had made was from No Limit. I started out after reading like Harrington on Hold'em a couple times, and then what's the old Skolansky Ed Miller book, No Limit Hold'em Theory and Practice or something.
Yep.
after reading that and figuring out how to do EV calculations, something, I ended up putting $1,000, which was probably like a third of my net worth at the time, on Bovada and playing 25 NL, and then spending another maybe about $1,000. So now I'm in for about two thirds of my net worth on coaching with Andrew Seidman. And then in the span of about a year and a half, I went from 25 NL to playing 1K, playing 510 on Bovada. And I think it was about 15 lessons I ended up taking with Andrew. But yeah, then I was beating 10-20 on Bovada for a while, maybe about a year straight, and I was starting to get kind of losing interest a little bit. And I had come across an idea, or I'd figured out that I could take PioSolver and make PLO abstractions with PioSolver, just kind of using the hold'em hands as like equity stand-ins for PLO hands. And then that allowed me to start studying PLO, because I had been very solver intensive once PioSolver came along. And then once I was able to make these abstractions, I was able to figure out kind of like what the framework for three bet pots in PLO looks like. And then I started transitioning to playing more of that. That takes me up to about the end of last year, and then kind of like the floor fell in, and I had probably the most difficult period of my life, where I had a grandfather that I was close with pass away. My grandfather on my dad's side also passed away. A partner that I was really in love with, we broke up. I was colluded out of about 100K, I think, on Bovada. Wow. In three-handed games. Yeah, it was pretty bad. I was pretty naive to not see it coming. I also had a good friend from college named Cameron. He had died tragically a few months before, and I think I hadn't even really processed that. So at that point, I went from being like probably a moderate winner to like moderate loser, and then don't even count the collusion. And I just stopped playing because it had gotten so dark, and I had reached such kind of a state where I was just almost non-functional. And from that, a lot of really good things came, because I had been trying to address issues with depression and with tilt and like anger that stemmed from poker, but I had never. I would essentially try one thing and not really commit to it and not make the other four or five changes that were required, and then get frustrated that one thing wasn't helping, unsurprisingly. Hmm. And so at that point, around the beginning of the year, I just made five or six like dramatic changes in my life, and that kind of reoriented my trajectory, I guess I would say.
Are you open to enumerating those changes?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I had been, I had injured my back years ago, and so sitting for long periods really causes me a lot of pain. So I started doing yoga all the time. I now go to a rock climbing gym. So I climb, do yoga, I lift weights twice a week with a trainer, and then started seeing a therapist, working on dealing with depression, dealing with frustration and anger, and like resolving kind of the underlying issues, which stem from somewhat from being abused as a kid, and like developing mechanisms for dealing with depression. I read a book on Stoicism, and I read a book called The Upward Spiral, about kind of healthy, non-medicated ways to deal. You can deal with depression. And I've found that I've gotten to a point where I can kind of see it coming, and by articulating to myself what's happening, I can really minimize the downward slope of the trajectory of depression when it's coming.
Sounds like a valuable thing to be able to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think writing the book was also something that it allowed me to kind of like exercise some demons. And I had gotten to the point where my thought process in poker had been so eroded that I was probably like playing with the skill that I had at like 25 or 50 NL, because I was just so unable to access those higher order thought processes. And so writing the book was a way to come back and remind myself of like, oh, I actually know quite a lot about how game theory works in poker, and how to use that to exploit people and how to play in a balanced way. And then I'm going to use a supercomputer that I have to do this analysis with this new solver and try to produce something of value. And so all of those things kind of coalesced and really brought me out of a place that was incredibly dark. It's kind of like, are you familiar with the term in evolution called a punctuated equilibrium?
Yes.
Yeah. So for people who aren't familiar with that term, Darwin used to think, or people had used to think about evolution, that it was like just a slow, gradual build up. But in fact, there are probably long periods where nothing changes because there's no environmental pressures, and then periods of like rapid change where it's like kill or be killed, or there's like a new ice age sets in and the whole environment changes, and so like rapid evolutionary change happens in maybe like 10,000 years. And I kind of feel like that's what had happened in my life, where I had a couple years of stagnation and then just rapid growth over the course of maybe the first 6 months of this year.
So when you were learning poker, it was natural for you to hire a coach. And this is a common thread among a lot of the most successful people we've had on the show at poker. And when you're having trouble with depression, it was natural for you to go see a therapist. And, you know, that's a very smart thing to do and something. Go get help, right? Is this something that comes naturally to you?
The seeking a coach for chess and poker was supernatural. Until recently was still in contact with my chess coach, who was probably the most eccentric, brilliant, but also non-functional person you'll ever meet. He's kind of like, think Woody Allen in Annie Hall, but if you sped it up to like 1.5 speed, because it's just like so rapid fire, but also like with a gambling addiction, and but also like a brilliant like a child prodigy in piano and international master in chess. So in chess and poker, it is very natural for me to pursue these things. It's funny, I have a degree in psychology, and I was very resistant for a long time to go and get therapy. And the reason, even though my partner at the time pushed me to do it, I think I had poor interactions with therapists up to that point, where I was feeling more like positive psychology philosophy. So it's just like, you're great, you're awesome. Like, no, I mean, there's some shit about me I'd like to change. So let's take a more cognitive behavioral therapy approach, and like let's kind of put the past in the past and like fix the issues that are here now. So yeah, there was a lot of resistance, but like losing someone that you really love was enough to catalyze me to make that big jump and get over the fear.
Do you feel, I mean, obviously the depression is much deeper than poker. I mean, did you feel like the kind of stress of poker and the inherent like self-doubt is seems to come to almost all, you know, serious poker players. Do you feel like that was kind of a poor choice? How do you feel like that like interacted with the issues that you already had?
Yeah, it certainly exacerbated them at some point, and that's one of the reasons that I'm moving away from poker and feel like I'm transitioning to learning other things and maybe just going to do poker part-time.
Because there are no depressed writers.
Yeah, not that there are no depressed writers, but the feeling of being under fire constantly and like the fight or flight response, that kind of in conjunction with having back pain, which I tend to like hunch my back over as I'm playing. It's hard to maintain good posture. So I've got that pain, which certainly can either trigger or kind of work together with the natural depressive tendencies that I have and kind of create that downward spiral. So yeah, I think having poker as the main thing in my life is not a healthy choice for me anymore. I wanted to be the person who is able to overcome all the obstacles and the hurdles so that I could really get back to the top. I don't think I think that I see myself as having the ability to learn pretty much anything I want to learn. And so I'd like to move towards learning new skills and becoming even more well-rounded, I hope.
Well, I know you said you made a lot of use of solvers when you were playing No Limit. Was that also a big part of your chess study? I mean, were you using like chess computers pretty intensively?
I really wasn't. I mean, I certainly used them a little bit. I don't think that I had learned a healthy methodology for using them. And I think that when I was starting to use them in No Limit, I wasn't using them properly either. And in chess, it was mostly using books and reviewing games with my coach and kind of like struggling to find the variations ourselves. And then when I was using the solvers, it started out as like purely mimicry. Like I'm going to try to imitate the solver, which it's almost nice that PLO is so complicated because it just disabuses you of that notion that you'll ever be able to imitate it. In No Limit, there's kind of that trap that there's like, oh, there's only the 1,326 possible hands. Each range is already pretty small because we've raised pre-flop. And so I can just imitate it. I'm like, no, that's not, you're not going to be able to do that. You wouldn't want to. The point is that no one ever is playing balanced. And so it's like the equilibrium is only there to show you where the exploits are. And so once I started thinking about it in those terms, and then I would start to do things like 3-bet pre-flop and then check my whole range on like a monotone board in No Limit. And then the flop would check through, and then I would exploitatively like overbet the turn and jam rivers because I know people weren't slow playing enough nut flushes, second nut flushes, and we're not calling wide enough. And so I would do like, I would start to employ that kind of like massively exploitative things, but using the solver to help guide me. And once I started doing that, I was like beating 5-10 for 11 BB per 100 on Bovada, and then like 10-20 for maybe 6 BB or something like that. Just because like people didn't, there weren't screen names. So no one knew you were the guy who was capable of like 3x overbet shoving because they had checked back the turn 2-capped.
That's very cool. I think a lot of people would have said those win rates are impossible these days.
Maybe they aren't. This was already maybe a year, 2 years ago. And so I'm sure the games have gotten tougher on Bovada, like especially when they started accepting Bitcoin and like you didn't have to run up a roll, which is kind of what you had to do. But I think, yeah, people are very limited by what they think is possible. It reminds me of, I think it was maybe either a Planet Money or Freakonomics podcast when they interviewed, is it Kobayashi, the hot dog eating guy?
Yep.
And so like everybody had been eating like 10 hot dogs up to that point. And then he just like ate 30 and then everyone else came up because they're like, oh, that's what's possible. So then like, then everyone else starts doing it. So it's like as soon as you realize stop thinking about what's possible and just focus on learning, then I think, yeah, things like that can occur.
Well, it was very generous of you to share the book with me, and I feel like I'm making a big mistake. I don't play that much PLO, and I really wanted to read it in preparation for this interview, and I have read some of it, but it's obviously quite dense, and I don't have experience. I mean, I have a fair amount of experience with limit solvers, but I had never even looked at like a PLO solver output before, even like thought much about how to. It seems like just kind of wrapping your head around it. There's this whole other separate set of problems because with looking at four card hands, there's kind of like the two primary cards that are making up, the majority of your equity on many flops. But then, like, obviously, it matters quite a bit what those other two cards are. And even just thinking about, like, how to categorize types of hands, you can look at a no-limit solver and you can sort of say, okay, sets are mostly doing this. And, whether or not you have a backdoor flush draw tends to determine whether or not you're peeling the flop with bottom pair. Just, like, things like that. I feel like in no-limit, and maybe that's just having more experience with no-limit solvers, but, I mean, did you have this trouble of even...
next to each other. Like, that's hard. Now make those ranges like 150,000 combos or something, and it's like, forget it. And that's why in the book I invented those strategy graphs to help visualize the solutions in ways that no one had done before. And that's because I found the solver completely inaccessible without some kind of way to visualize the flow of the strategy. And so that's why I created those. And I think that's one of the elements that makes the book unique is that it gives you a view of a PLO strategy that you wouldn't otherwise have.
Yeah, I was going to ask if you think that's sort of a fair, I don't know that you quite call it the elevator pitch for the book, but a way of helping people to make sense of what they're getting from. So like, it seems like you basically have to be using a solver alongside the book or you're not going to get a whole lot out of it.
Using this solver
in conjunction with the book. I guess that was part of my issue also. It was like I didn't have it. Maybe I could have just downloaded one. But do you feel like it's sort of essential to be using a solver in conjunction with the book, right? I mean, the book, I mean, not that there's not explicit strategy lessons in there, but it seems like a big part of what you would potentially get from the book is how to do solver work more effectively on your own.
Actually, I wrote the book with the intention that wasn't the case. And so like,
I haven't finished it. So that was really just my guess.
Yeah. Yeah. So there are a lot of like different, I try to create these strategy heuristics where I take like a really top-down approach where you take like the widest lens possible and then I turn those into kind of phrases that help you kind of order your range in your mind. Thinking about, okay, in 4-bet pots, people just kind of automatically shove everything and they don't really think about position. And so I take the reader through these steps and I say, okay, we need to start considering position and considering like how position impacts or how EV impacts position. And so, like, I give the example of when you're out of position, you are comparing the EV of a check or the comparing the EV of a bet to the EV of a check and facing a bet, or the EV of all of your opponent's possible decisions. And so that inclines you to bet more mediocre hands, because like the threshold for betting is lower, because what happens when you check with something that has like 40% equity is your opponent creates a range that's polarized and pushes hands like that closer to indifference. So hands in that range tend to perform better as bets, or the EV tends to be higher. But whereas in position, we generally want to polarize more because the EV of a check back is much higher, so the threshold for betting has to be higher. And so you see a lot more polarization in position. And so even in something like a four-bet pot, there's actually something to be said for checking back with a lot of hands and like looking for turns to hero fold, looking for turns that slightly improve you, and so you could more happily call off and accept your 2-to-1 pot odds. And so I kind of like build on this example, and like 4-bet pots usually have an SPR of about 1, and so you can apply those lessons to lessons that you learn when you are in a 3-bet pot and somebody pots the flop and you get to the turn and the SPR is 1. And so there's actually kind of like this building process. So I did write it actually with the intention that you wouldn't have to use a solver. I think you certainly would get even more out of it if you do. But I definitely had in mind like strong players that didn't really want to go and pay for server space or buy a computer with 128 gigs of RAM or something.
So I'm sorry to cut you off, but I think Nate is going to have to go in a second. Is there anything else? I mean, I guess at the very least, tell people where they can pick up the book if they're interested in it. But anything else that you wanted to say about the book before you go?
No, I think that covers it. So the book you can find the on QuickPro, PLO QuickPro. It's where it's being sold. There's also, if you want to read comments, there is a thread on Run It Once in the High Stakes PLO forum. And I think my name on there is Restacks. So you can find, I think it's very obvious where it'll say new PLO book. Also, this won't come out. Our interview won't come out for a few weeks.
Correct, yeah.
So I recently, Phil Galfond read the book and is excited about it, and actually had me come on and make videos with him using kind of the same methodology that I use in the book. And so those will be coming out on Run It Once, presumably before this interview is released. So that's pretty exciting.
Nice.
Well, yeah, fantastic.
I don't know if there's a way to link to those, but I'll see what I can do.
Oh yeah, I can get you a link for them.
Cool. Well, thanks very much. If you guys have final comments, feel free to, finish up and then shut down the call. I have to run to the doctor. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to meet you, and sorry to run off. And it's really been great. Thank you.
Yeah, great to meet you, Nate.
Take care.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Corey. I enjoyed getting another chance to talk to you here, and I really appreciate your being so open about everything, and your whole story I found very compelling. I appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on. I look forward to hearing more podcasts. I think I've listened to pretty much everyone, and I look forward to the future ones.
Thank you for that as well. It never ceases to flatter me that people choose to spend their time with us.
Yeah, it definitely is the NPR of poker podcasts.
I'm glad Nate wasn't around here. All right, take care.
All right, bye-bye.
Sleepless nights, do I need some kind of pill? Or the devotion of a car?